This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. We're starting this week's show at the Cathedral of St. Joseph in Hartford, Connecticut. This is the sound from a video uploaded in June. It's the ordination of two priests. We're starting here because one of the biggest sports stories of the past decade actually prepared one of these men for the priesthood. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
On the night of February 17th, 2012, Anthony Federico was working his job at the ESPN headquarters in Bristol, Connecticut. Anthony was an editor for ESPN's mobile website. He was responsible for deciding what stories people would see if they went to ESPN on their phones. Around 2:30 the next morning, Anthony hit publish on a new headline.
A headline that I had used myself many times before and that sports media sites have been using for years. And about a half hour later, I realized that it had been going viral for the wrong reason. When I realized how the social media world was taking that headline, I got up from my desk and I went to the bathroom and I threw up several times because I was aghast and horrified at what was going down.
The headline was quickly changed. Anthony spoke to his boss, who tried to console him. But when Anthony left the office, he says he was still distraught. He drove to his parents' house
and woke them up maybe like 4:30 in the morning. And I told them what happened. And they were like, okay, this will blow over. And it did not.
That became clear a few hours later.
That same boss called me early in the morning and it's like, don't turn on your phone. Don't look at the web. Don't look at anything. It's bad. And I asked, how bad is it? And he said, it's bad.
Anthony Federico grew up outside New Haven, Connecticut.
I grew up in a big Italian-American family. I'm the oldest of five kids and the best-looking and the smartest and the most athletic of the five kids. No, I'm just kidding. And we grew up in a very culturally Catholic family.
Anthony loved sports. He swam and played tennis, baseball, and hockey. He went to Notre Dame High School, then Providence College, a Catholic university in Rhode Island.
A lot of guys growing up in Connecticut that are sports fans maybe have it in the back of their mind to work for ESPN someday.
So after graduating from Providence, Anthony got a job as a temp in ESPN's tape library. He'd go to a huge warehouse to track down videotapes for the different ESPN shows.
Put it in a basket of a bicycle because the warehouse was so big that I would ride this bicycle around, you know, getting all the different tapes that had been requested.
Then Anthony would return to the ESPN campus to deliver the tapes.
And it was cool because I got to meet a lot of different people all over ESPN's campus, and I was asking questions like, what do you do and what is your job like? And I made a lot of friends that way.
In 2007, after about 6 months working the tape library, 23-year-old Anthony Federico landed in that role as a content editor for ESPN's mobile website.
It was really cool. My job was to watch the night of sports unfold and kind of make editorial decisions in real time about what stories we're going to lead with, what angles we're going to promote.
And so you're writing the headlines and you're hitting publish. There wasn't like someone to look it over before it goes out there.
Yes. Yes. It's everything needs to happen 5 minutes ago, kind of sense of urgency, you know, deadline culture. And that was part of the draw of it, how exciting and fast paced my work was. And yeah, everything happens very quickly.
So jumping ahead a little bit, tell me,
sure,
what's going on in the sports world in early February of 2012?
The talk of the sports world was Jeremy Lin.
Lin to the basket, reverse slam, he puts it in!
The meteoric rise of Jeremy Lin from point guard at Harvard to catching on with the Knicks.
Lin puts it up, bang! Jeremy Lin from downtown!
And leading the Knicks on a winning streak that had the sports world buzzing. I believe he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated 2 issues in a row.
How could this guy go undrafted in the NBA? How could he get cut by 2 teams this year?
From bench warmer to big star overnight, New York.
He's a devout Christian.
The only Asian American player in the league.
For Anthony Federico, Lin's sanity wasn't just a great story. The Knicks had always been his favorite team.
It was exciting.
And that brings us back to the night of February 17th, 2012. Anthony was at his desk at ESPN, and Jeremy Lin and the Knicks were playing the New Orleans Hornets.
and he played poorly.
He had 9 turnovers in this game, but he did.
And the Knicks lost.
The winning streak is over for Jeremy Lin.
And at 2:30 in the morning, I wrote a headline to reflect his first display of weakness as a starter for the Knicks. And I wrote the headline, "Chink in the Armor."
This was the headline that went viral, that sent Anthony into the bathroom to throw up.
I was shocked that people were misinterpreting this headline as a racial slur and not as an expression to describe, you know, his first display of weakness.
Anthony would later say the headline was a lapse in judgment and an awful editorial omission. When Anthony woke up a few hours after the headline was published, the story was all over the internet.
My name and address got leaked to the media, so the paparazzi started following me around and started getting hate mail and death threats from all over the world, and a lot of the late-night talk shows were roasting me, and, you know, my face was on a lot of newspapers, and I was this big racist villain. It was brutal.
And how did you come to learn that you'd been fired?
I was fired via conference call 3 or 4 days later.
Wow. Do you remember what was said during that conference call?
Yeah, I do. I'm not going to get into it.
Okay. Did you feel like you should have been fired?
I appreciate that that was a headline that I should have foreseen the consequences to. And I would have loved to have been defended that I was a good employee for a number of years and that everyone who knew me at the company spoke very highly of my character.
So what happened next for you?
Yeah, those were the worst 30 days of my life. I filed for unemployment, which is humbling. My family was great. My close friends were great. I started looking for work, but I was, as you might imagine, pretty toxic in the sports media industry. I thought that I didn't deserve what happened to me, and I blamed God for that. And I thought about killing myself several times. And then Jeremy Lin himself reached out to me. I got an email from his cousin. It was polite and gracious, and it was just, when they get back from their next road trip, he'd like to meet you in Manhattan for lunch. And at first I was like, yeah, right. Just some prankster having fun with me.
But Anthony checked it out. The invitation was real. Heading into the lunch with Jeremy Lin, Anthony was nervous. He didn't need to be.
He told me that he didn't think that the headline was racial in intent, and that was so huge to hear him. I'm eternally grateful to him for his kindness. So we talked about the headline for a few minutes, and then we talked mostly about the world and our faith.
Do you view that as like a turning point, at least for your mental health and well-being?
Very much so. I felt like that was a moment of, wow, he didn't have to do this. In fact, it probably would have been easier for him to just let it go. That is the kind of gesture that someone doesn't forget.
Around that same time, Anthony landed a new job with a sports media startup in Stamford, Connecticut. He says it felt like now his life could start over again.
Oh, it was such relief.
During his lunch breaks, Anthony started going on walks around Stamford.
On one of my walks, I happened upon a Catholic church, a busy basilica in the middle of downtown Stamford that was having Mass during the day. And I didn't even know that Catholics go to Mass on weekdays and not just on Sundays. But the doors were open. I could see them going to church on there. And, oh, maybe that could be cool, but nah, I'm not that kind of guy. So on the first day, I go past it, and second day, I go past it, and how biblical. On the third day, I decide I'm going to go to church in the middle of the afternoon on a Wednesday, and I went into this 12:10 Mass. The regulars kind of called it the suit and tie Mass because all the businessmen and women would leave their offices and come to Mass on their lunch break, and I started going to Mass every day on my lunch break, and it's this oasis of stillness and silence and ritual, and it was just such a sharp contrast that it called to me.
Anthony noticed that every day before Mass, the priest would hear confession.
And often the line was so long for people going to confession that the priest would have to apologize to the five or six people still waiting in line because he had to run up and start the Mass on time. And every day I would see on this priest's face this, like, anguish. So I was watching him one day and I said, "Lord, if only we had more priests, we could have two lines of confession going at, oh, if only we had more priests."
Anthony says that as a kid, people had told him he should grow up to be a priest, but he hadn't really taken the idea seriously until now.
I applied to be a seminarian for the Archdiocese of Hartford, Connecticut, and I was accepted. I thought I would go to seminary for 1 month and hate it, but I was there for 6 years, and I've never been happier. And then just last June 22nd, I was ordained a priest of Jesus Christ for the Catholic Church.
How do you think this awful experience you had with, you know, social media outrage and facing death threats and all that, how do you think that will shape you as a priest?
I think a sense of sympathy for what people are going through and how everyone has a story that goes deeper than their worst moment or one thing they put out on the internet. And I have a sense of what it's like to be angry at God in this big way, and I can relate to them when they bring me their struggles and their hopes and their dreams and their fears. And I think that that feeling of being abandoned by God was part of this whole process of preparing me for priesthood.
Father Anthony Federico is now assigned to St. Bridget of Sweden Parish in Cheshire, Connecticut. He says he still avidly follows the Yankees and Knicks. And how much do you follow Jeremy Lin's career at this point?
Yeah, I would say casually, but with interest when his name does come up. I said a prayer for him recently when he was kind of public about his free agency situation.
Back in July, Lin, who since that incredible two-week stretch with the Knicks in 2012 has struggled with injuries and bounced around to six different NBA teams, spoke on a Christian TV station in Taiwan. Lin was crying as he said, "Rock bottom just seems to keep getting more and more rock bottom for me. I feel like in some ways the NBA has kind of given up on me."
I hope he finds whatever it is he's looking for as well.
Have you been in touch with him at all since your lunch?
I have not.
I hope you guys can reconnect at some point.
Yeah, that would be cool. I feel like God knows what his schedule's like, but as a priest, my priority is my people and my parish, and if it ever worked out that we could get together, that would be great. And if not, that's cool too, because I have such great affection for him.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Jeremy Lin now plays in the Chinese Basketball Association. With all the news about the dangers of repetitive head trauma, high school football numbers are down. But at the college level, the sport is actually growing. That story is coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning, and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed. And now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, up first to start your weekend from NPR News.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. Even before the Seahawks, the Texans, the Ravens, and the Chiefs made it to the NFL playoffs, this was already being called the year of the black quarterback. Now, there are four African-American starting quarterbacks in the divisional round, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Jerry, start us off.
Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, and Russell Wilson. These are four of the quarterbacks remaining in the field, four of the Elite Eight. And I think that you could argue we are in a period in which we've never had this many elite black quarterbacks ever. So much so that I'm not sure that there is just this grand acknowledgement that they are black. I think we're looking at them as just dynamic playmakers. The NFL is changing. I think the way that their styles of play are being accepted alludes to that. Running, throwing, being improvisational geniuses. That shows how much the sport is evolving. Everyone always worries, oh, these guys run around a lot. They get hit a lot. They're going to get more hurt than Peyton Manning or Brady or Breeze. But I think we're getting to the point where we're accepting that these guys are going to be the faces of the NFL.
I want to go back to your point that it's almost like we're not acknowledging that these black quarterbacks are excelling and including their blackness in that discussion. And it's funny to me because I feel like the last few days we've been talking a lot about the head coach hiring cycle mm-hmm. and the lack of black and other minority hires. And yet we do not seem to be bolstering that with a simultaneous discussion of, look what's going on the field. Mm-hmm. Look at who's going to be leading the NFL going into the next decade or so.
Right. What feels important to me is that it can't be called a fluke anymore. Even with Lamar Jackson 2 years ago, we were still hearing, like, I'm not sure that his style of play is going to work in the NFL. Like, that was 2 years ago. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
And it feels like with quarterbacks this year, we are at a place where there's no going back. And the same thing sort of can happen with coaches. Jerry, does the fact that we now see black quarterbacks on the field give us any hope for the coaching staffs?
I think there is some level of hope, but I mean, that is a more complicated ceiling to break through for many reasons. I think we are still probably, at best, I would say 2 decades behind. Hmm. They get a job, but then it's one of the league's worst jobs.
Right.
And then they get fired in 2 or 3 years, and then nobody wants to rehire them because they failed at one of the worst jobs in the NFL. But I think any positive change in this direction, I mean, a quarterback is as vital to the success of an NFL team as the head coach is. And so being able to put these guys front and center and say, not only are they capable of starting and leading your team, they're capable of being franchise players, and you can win championships with these guys. The people who are leading your organization can be of color, and it can be a damn good thing for your institution.
Absolutely. All right. So speaking of very, very good quarterbacks, Nora.
Okay. So I need help. You know, the Patriots, mainstay in the NFL playoffs for better part of the last 2 decades, basically. And they're out. They're out in the wild card round. I don't know what to do with myself this month. I haven't had a relaxed January since 8th grade. Tom Brady is going to be a free agent this March. So it is more possible than it has ever been that he could play for another team. You know, not only do I feel thrust into this sort of sitting at my kitchen table in my pajamas at 11 o'clock every morning being like, what's going to happen to me? And dissecting, you know, social media posts. Would Brady and Giselle live in Charlotte? Is that possible? Would she agree to that? The answer to that is no. But I'm curious, from your guys' perspectives, is it exciting? Is it gleeful? Is it suspenseful?
Wow. It feels weird. that's the number one thing. But it also feels right in a strange way. Mm-hmm. You know, they've won 6, and they probably look back and they could point to a half a dozen plays in which they could have 12 championships over the last 20 years. And so that's why I say it feels right that they finally got eliminated. They lost a home playoff game to a team in which the opposing quarterback didn't even throw for 80 yards. And so for the first time, it feels like they are legitimately at a crossroads.
Yeah.
The right thing to do in terms of cutthroat NFL business, I believe, would be to move on. Team is too old, oldest team in the league. The right thing to do in terms of the emotional side is let this run continue.
I don't want Tom Brady to go. I love Tom Brady. Tom, stay. If you're listening, stay. But it feels to me like everyone in Boston is ignoring all these very good reasons why maybe Tom Brady would want to look elsewhere. And maybe the Patriots would want to think about what their next few years look like. And I'm sitting here saying, you all might want to prepare yourself for the possibility that he could leave so that when he stays, you're pleasantly surprised.
I think that's right, because there are a couple places, the Raiders, the Chargers, maybe the Dolphins. I don't think he would have any, you know, real emotional problem with it. I'm just sick, like Tom Brady, Jacksonville Jaguar. Come on.
Maybe not.
Come on.
All right. As y'all know by now, college football's title game will kick off Monday night at 8 Eastern. Clemson will face LSU in New Orleans. LSU's semester begins on Monday. And despite a lot of bellyaching by students and a change.org petition with a few thousand signatures, LSU says they will not cancel classes on Monday or Tuesday. And I'm here to say, rightly so. No, I'm not, because that's ridiculous. Look, it's quite possible that a few students will show up for classes on Monday morning, maybe early afternoon, but Tuesday morning classes, forget about it.
Absolutely. I mean, the national title game is in New Orleans, and it's not like LSU makes it every year.
Right.
They are one of the great traditions in college football, but they're not like Alabama is right now. This is perhaps a once-in-a-decade opportunity for this program. And you're not being led, by the way, this time by Les Miles or a Nick Saban. You're being led by a Louisiana boy. The sound of his voice just is like the embodiment of gumbo.
Next week, and then we're going to head on down to New Orleans on Friday night. Guys came back with a great spirit today.
He is a native son going for a national championship in New Orleans. You should not start school before Wednesday. And I'm not even sure if you should even have it at all this week.
Take that, nerds.
Nora.
So the first day back to classes after winter break is syllabus day. You don't do anything in class on that day. You just get your syllabus and your professor has a lovely PowerPoint. And they basically go through something that could be an email. You don't need it. They don't need to be there. If you go to LSU, don't go to school. Don't go to school, kids. Oh. Go watch sports and be happy and hang out with your friends.
See, Nora, the problem with your thought process here is that you and I were big rule followers in school, which means that we would get our syllabus and we would read it regardless of whether we were stuck in a classroom where someone read it to us. But I'm not really sure that's true of every college student.
Syllabus day is pointless. End syllabus day.
Oh, dear. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Stay in school.
Stop me if you've heard this one already.
New research shows that high school football is taking a hit in participation.
Dropping by more than 30,000 nationwide to its lowest numbers in 20 years.
Some parents are telling us that the dangers of playing football are no longer a secret.
People are getting conscious. Parents are getting conscious.
And many high school teams are shrinking or outright shutting down.
So, with all the focus on concussions and all the news reports of football losing ground at the high school level, I think our listeners might have the impression that colleges must be backing away from the sport at this point. But overall, that's not what's happening, right?
That's correct. And it's a sort of popular perception that it's in decline everywhere, but that's really not so.
That's Bill Pennington. He's a reporter with the New York Times, and he recently wrote about what's actually happening in college football.
There are schools and institutions that are dropping the sport, about 23 in the last 10 years. I'm sure there will be more, perhaps many more. But in that same 10-year period, 66 institutions have added college football, and seven more are planning to next year. It's sort of the dichotomy that's going on about this sport in America. There are people that see it as a danger, and this includes colleges that see it as a danger or an unwanted headache. And there are schools that see it as a panacea for all kinds of things.
All right. So to prove this point, you compared two schools. Both of them are in Massachusetts, Northeastern University in Boston and Anna Maria College, about 60 miles to the west near Worcester. How did you come up with that idea? Because frankly, I'm a bit surprised that someone with the New York Times has even heard of Anna Maria.
Well, I have heard of Anna Maria. I am from Northern Connecticut, so maybe I'm just a little more versed in what's going on around in the Worcester area. Look, we looked at the list of schools that had dropped and at the list that had added. Granted, most of the ones that have added, but not all, are smaller colleges. So Anna Maria fit that, you know, as a prototype. The other school we chose was Northeastern, which fit the prototype for dropping. Now, granted, they're two very different kinds of institutions and size and the kinds of students that they attract. That's part of the story, too, is right. That football means different things in different places.
Let's start with the school that dropped football. That was Northeastern, and this is how their decision was reported on this very program back in November of 2009.
On Monday, the football program at Northeastern University in Boston was thrown for the ultimate loss when athletics director Peter Roby announced the elimination of the sport. Northeastern hadn't had a winning season since 2004, but lots of college football teams lose more often than they win. Northeastern's problem, according to Roby, was money.
It was going to require investments in the multiples of millions of dollars, and I just didn't feel I could make that recommendation to the senior leadership of the institution.
You also spoke with Peter Roby. What did he tell you about how he delivered that news and how it was received?
I think he had given a lot of forethought to it. The university had planned for this moment for a few months, it seemed like. They understood that they were abandoning, for lack of a better word, about 70 football players, that this was going to be really rough news for them and for their families, for the coaches. So Peter Roby told me about that, and he went into it knowing people are going to be devastated in that room when you're delivering that news to that group. And that's exactly what happened. And so there was, you know, players crying, sobbing, cursing at him. So it was a very emotional meeting, as it always is when a sport is dropped, especially one that sort of has the prominence of football.
So how has that decision turned out for Northeastern? Has the school suffered horribly for having gotten rid of football?
No, quite the opposite. It seems to be hardly missed. Applications have more than doubled. Research funding has nearly tripled. In just about all the sort of obvious ways, Northeastern has had a great 10 years since it dropped football. Now, I don't think anybody there really says it's because we dropped football, but it's interesting that it has certainly not held them back.
Around the same time that Northeastern decided to eliminate its football program, Anna Maria added the sport. Can you describe Anna Maria College for me? Because all the photos that accompany your article make it look like it's in the middle of the woods.
Well, it is a little bit. it's more of a suburb, I guess. It's a small campus, 190 acres. It's very sort of peaceful, tranquil. It's like a lot of small colleges you'd see in New England. It was a former all-girls school, and it went co-ed in the early 70s. But it's a nice, bucolic, private little place.
So 10 years ago, when Anna Maria made this decision to add football, what were they hoping it would do?
The goal, and I actually wrote a story about schools like this adding football 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. The reasons then are the same as they are now. It increases the number of male applicants just because you get 100 admitted. So that, for a school with an enrollment of, at the time, 750, 800, that's a big boost. A football team tends to attract other male applicants, even if they don't plan on playing football. They want to go to a school where there is a football team. The school was about 70% female at the time, so they get that. It's also true, and this may be the most important part, at least in terms of understanding this phenomenon, nobody's on scholarship in Anna Maria. This is a Division III school where athletic scholarships are prohibited in all sports. And so these players are paying their way, maybe not the entire cost, but I was told that the average football player is paying about $20,000 a year. You know, do the math. I mean, 100 or 110 players times 20,000, that's quite a bit of revenue. And this is going on all over America. There are a lot of young men out there who are finishing up their high school football careers and don't want to stop playing. They're not good enough to go play Division I, but they are good enough to contribute on the Division III level, and here's a chance for them to keep playing.
So while a Division I school like Northeastern can save a whole lot of money by getting rid of their football program, a school like Anna Maria can make a lot of money.
Correct. Absolutely. And because there's no athletic scholarships, because the coaches are not coaches maybe that have built up the experience where they're going to earn a salary of, you know, several hundred thousand dollars or millions, you don't need eight trainers. You don't need chartered jets to get you around to games. And so the costs are very low. It's a revenue boost for these schools, absolutely.
I've been making a lot of jokes about nobody knowing about Anna Maria College, but actually my husband went there and taught there for a while. And it's a place that he's told me where there's really just not anything to do. You're outside of Worcester, but it's not easy to get to downtown. You're kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of schools like that in America. You know, if the basketball team is really good, people will come to the basketball games. If the hockey team is really good, they will come to the hockey games. But if they're just mediocre, then nobody will come to the games. And football, I mean, they haven't had a winning team. They've had 11 successive losing seasons, and people still come to the games. And there's still sort of a buzz on campus that weekend. And alumni come out and tailgate before the game and after the game. You know, that's part of why these schools are adding football. It just creates a different vibe. And for those kinds of schools, and certain of them, and there's many of them, this is exactly what they're seeking.
We've talked a little about how Anna Maria is representative of the schools that are adding football. Let's talk about why Northeastern is representative of the schools that are getting rid of it. Are they mostly schools that are in urban areas that are potentially Division One that have more expensive programs and that have, I don't know, communities that have other things to focus on?
Generally, often what it comes down to is they're not winning a lot. It's not like an integral part of the university's culture. It's very different at the University of Michigan, let's say, where it is, or Notre Dame or Alabama or dozens and dozens of other Division One schools where it's an integral part of that fall culture. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if in the future more of the decisions are based on things like we don't want to be associated with a game where there seems to be a danger to your brain. There aren't many schools that have said, we're dropping the program because, you know, we have a problem with the sport in general.
That's Bill Pennington of the New York Times. We'll have a link to his article, Adding Football Saved One College, Dumping It Boosted Another, at onlyagame.org. Just weeks before the 2018 Olympics were set to begin, members of the South Korean women's ice hockey team learned that North Korean players would be added to the roster.
To have something like this happen is just like the rug being completely swept out from under you, and not all of us are going to play now.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Queer Eye's Karamo Brown still remembers what his teacher said years ago on his first day at a new school.
What kind of name is that?
Mm.
And I remember just shrinking in my seat and feeling like I don't want to be different.
The stories behind the celebrity. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, how Davidson College's sports teams improved with help from its math students. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
College football championship, Monday night. Who do you like, the team with the delightfully Southern coach or the other team with the delightfully Southern coach?
I'll pick the team with the delightfully Southern coach who doesn't bother God quite as much as the guy from Clemson does. I'm a Coach O man all the way. I'm picking LSU.
Remember back when Clemson was the underdog, and now we get these stories about how Clemson quarterback Trevor Lawrence, who is undefeated at the college level, only lost one game in high school.
Yeah, this is a heck of a record, actually. And Jake Smith, who's a freshman at the Air Force Academy and is playing football there, he's the last quarterback to beat Trevor Lawrence. He beat him in the last game of their senior year in high school.
That is just amazing. Alabama quarterback Tua Tagovailoa will declare for the NFL draft. Tua was predicted to be a high first-round pick before he dislocated his right hip against Mississippi State 2 months ago. So then he had to choose between risking a lower draft pick or risking another injury while playing for free next season. Great system, eh?
Yeah, he made the right choice. I mean, there's no question about it. And I don't know where he'll go in the draft, because ever since Bo Jackson, NFL general managers are scared to death of hip injuries.
Yeah.
Because they can affect so much else. But someone will take a chance on him for sure. I mean, he's a very talented guy. I could still see him being a top 10 pick.
For the third year in a row, the New Orleans Saints were eliminated from the playoffs on the final play of a game. The first time it was unlucky. The second time it was a bad call. This time, well, I guess it depends on who you ask, right?
Yeah, the Saints fans are beginning to think everything is aligned against them. There was an obvious push-off on the winning touchdown. And, of course, that was in direct violation of the rule they put in place. So what happened to the Saints last year wouldn't happen again.
Well, TV analyst and former NFL head coach Tony Dungy says pass interference should have been called on that last play of the Saints game against the Vikings. The league says otherwise. Either way, at least nobody's putting up billboards saying the Saints should be in the Super Bowl this year, right?
Not yet. Not yet. Give it time. People in Louisiana
time.
Have a lot of money.
Okay, what's wrong with the following headline? Houston Dash trade J.J. Watt's fiance to Chicago.
She has a name, and she's a talented athlete. And the newspaper should be ashamed of itself. And J.J. Watt wants to come in there and do some damage.
Rightly so. I mean, I feel like we've been through this before. Does no one remember wife of Bears lineman wins bronze medal?
Exactly right. I was thinking of that myself, yeah.
And then to make things worse, ABC 13 apologized to JJ instead of, I don't know, apologizing to Kalia Ojai, a woman who does, in fact, have a name.
And is, in fact, a talented athlete. There are going to be male star athletes and female star athletes who fall in love and get married. Somebody find a coping strategy for this, please.
Junior Johnson died this week at the age of 88. Johnson was a NASCAR driver and owner whose career was interrupted briefly because he was convicted for running moonshine in 1956. How will you remember him?
I will remember him. I went to North Wilkesboro, which is the old and now defunct NASCAR track about half a mile from Junior Johnson's home. And I drove up to Junior Johnson's house, found him in his barn, and sat there and talked to him for 2 hours. And
wow.
He was incredibly delightful. And he talked to me about NASCAR, and he talked about North Wilkesboro closing, and he said, they're running races now in places like Phoenix and New Hampshire. And the way he said New Hampshire was like he was talking about Venus.
And finally, Charlie, the Maple Leafs are a storied NHL franchise adored by 8-year-old Jacob Bertrand. Maple Leaf Foods is a company that makes sandwich meats. And this distinction is important. Why?
Because young Jacob wanted a Maple Leafs logo on his cake.
Yeah.
And he got a Maple Leaf logo on his cake, but it was the logo for Maple Leaf Foods. And he just didn't want a bologna-themed cake, which I think, you know, he's the birthday guy. It's within his rights not to want a bologna-themed birthday cake. Neither would I, by the way.
So thanks to the mix-up, Maple Leaf Foods is now sending Jacob and his family to an all-expense-paid trip to Toronto. Jacob will get to see his very first Leafs game, so it all turned out okay, right?
Just don't let the people who are sponsoring the trip pick out the snack foods.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor for the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
In the months leading up to the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, tensions were high.
President Trump and Kim Jong-un trading threats of military action, each more severe than the last, after the president warned the U.S. was locked and loaded, North Korea responded.
But just weeks before the games began, a very different narrative emerged with the creation of the Unified Korean Women's Ice Hockey Team. The idea of a unified team was welcomed by many people, but not by all. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Grace Lee made the 2018 South Korean Women's Olympic Ice Hockey Team as a so-called import. a non-native player with enough Korean lineage to qualify. A few weeks before the Pyeongchang Olympics began, Lee was home in Colorado, resting and relaxing with family. Her dad told her he had heard rumors that North Korean players would be added to the South Korean roster.
And so I remember texting Randy and Marissa.
Those were teammates Randy Griffin and Marissa Brandt.
And Randy and Marissa were both like, no, it's not going to happen, don't worry. And then as days passed, you know, news grew and grew and grew. And then all of a sudden it was like, all right, so they are coming over.
The team had been training for 2 years at sites in South Korea and North America. There had been challenges to overcome, language, culture, and differences in hockey style. But the team had gelled. Now, nobody knew how the addition of players from North Korea would affect the squad.
2 weeks before the Olympics, that's really close.
That's forward Randy Griffin.
You're in maintenance mode at that point and just trying to mentally prepare yourself for this big event that you've been gearing up for. And to have something like this happen is just like the rug being completely swept out from under you. And there was also this immediate realization, like, not all of us are going to play now.
Under the rules set by the IOC, 12 North Korean players would be added to the existing roster of 23. Three North Koreans had to suit up for each game, meaning members of the original South Korean team would have to sit out to accommodate the new players.
It's just so heartbreaking when you see someone's dreams just being snatched from them at the last second.
Amid the disappointment, there were news reports of unrest in South Korea. Most younger South Koreans welcomed the merger. Most older South Koreans couldn't believe their nation had agreed to collaborate with the North. The South Korean players feared that the focus would be on politics, not on hockey, and that they'd already become political pawns. Just 2 weeks before their first Olympic game, players for the South Korean team met their new teammates. Journalist Seth Berkman was there.
It was a media circus, and all the South Korean players knew this is basically just a big photo opportunity kind of thing. And so standing out there in the freezing cold in the end of January, they were not very thrilled to be there.
We had been coached on exactly what to do and how to act.
And they stepped off the bus, and our coach had given, I think, seven of us flowers to give to them. And that exchange was super awkward because there's still a lot of resentment from our side. And you could tell a lot of the North Koreans were uncomfortable with the situation as well.
I'd say the first week or so, it was still very icy. There were so many handlers around the North Korean players that a lot of the South Koreans felt they couldn't make any kind of genuine attachment with them. But over time, whether that was finding time alone during lunch or in the cafeteria or even just sneaking around to each other's dorms, those walls started to break down a little bit.
On the ice, players spoke different languages. The South Koreans used English hockey terms, like pass. When the North Koreans wanted a pass, they'd say, contact me, in Korean. So a makeshift dictionary was created to help break down the language barrier. And the walls came down in other ways. South Korean defender Marissa Brandt befriended North Korean forward Kim Un-jung.
Marissa doesn't speak any Korean, Kim doesn't speak any English at all, but they had just kind of this rapport. And every day, Kim would go up to Marissa and kind of just signal that she wanted to see her cell phone. And so Marissa would hand it to her, and Kim would just stare at the photos of Marissa with her friends in the photo album for 10 minutes or so. And who only knows what she's thinking in that moment, but that was something Marissa definitely picked up on. What's life like for her?
On February 4th, after a week and a half of practice, the unified team was escorted by a police caravan to a 3,000-seat stadium in Incheon. There, they'd play an exhibition game against Sweden. When the tickets had gone on sale a week earlier, they sold out in minutes.
We got to the rink, and there's so many protesters just everywhere that we couldn't get through for at least half an hour to 45 minutes.
One side of the road was pro-Unified team supporters, the other were against it, and just kind of shouting chants back and forth to each other.
We had a line of policemen to our left and a line of policemen to our right. You know, they're wearing their helmets and they're holding up shields.
I think seeing the crowds and the protests, seeing that in person, it was kind of, I would say, a awakening.
When the game began, the unified team's shuffled lines produced little cohesion and flow. Sweden won the exhibition game 3-1. For the team's first official game on February 10th, North Korea sent dozens of cheerleaders, perky beauty queens clad in bright red uniforms.
Those cheerleaders were super weird. Like, what was up with that? They're not normal cheerleaders.
We could be on defense for 3 minutes, and they would just start chanting, you know, we are one, we are one. It's nice to have their support, but then again, it's like we're at a hockey game, and we're down 6-0, and so it's pretty tough to hear that.
It's not like, woo, they came here with their pom-poms because they love hockey. Like, no, they probably have really awful lives. And I'm not going to stand here and act like they're free people who came here and are doing this out of the pureness of their love for the sport or for Korea. Not at all.
Korea lost to Switzerland 8-0. But much of the media coverage focused on the presence of South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's sister and a host of other dignitaries.
And then after the game, they came down and wanted to speak to the team, good job, good effort kind of thing, which none of them wanted to hear at that point.
I think we all felt embarrassed and we wanted to just kind of be with each other. And we were like, wow, that was really hard.
On February 12th, the unified team lost to Sweden again by the score of 8-0.
And I actually at one point had a North Korean as my line mate for like a period. And I had one of my teammates lean over and she was like, you know, you shouldn't pass to her right in front of the net like that. She might score. We really don't want a North Korean to score. That would look terrible. That shows the level of conflict that I think players on our team were experiencing.
Korea lost the rest of its games. But Griffin says there were a couple of bright moments, like the 2-0 consolation round loss to Switzerland.
They're the defending bronze medal champions. We held them to 2 goals. To me, that's incredible. Nobody cared, but I'm like, we're capable of playing that way, and so we at least achieved that.
And during their days together, the ice had melted a bit. Players had dined together, listened to K-pop songs, and enjoyed each other's company. On the morning after the closing ceremonies, it was time for the North Koreans to leave. The team gathered at their bus. Many of the original South Korean players were struck by how sad they were to say goodbye to the North Korean players they had resented.
The North Koreans were dressed up in these sort of, I don't know, they looked like these little Russian hats and suits, very formal. And players gave them little trinkets that they could take home that wouldn't get them in trouble. And my experience of it was like, what world are these people going back to? It's really hard to think about that.
These days, Randy Griffin is a data scientist. Grace Lee plays hockey and studies at Yale. Both would appear to have bright futures. There's almost no chance they'll ever see the North Korean players again. So they'll just have to keep wondering what their ex-teammates' futures hold for them, and if their brief moment in the political spotlight changed anything.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Seth Berkman's book is A Team of Their Own, How an International Sisterhood Made Olympic History. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.